Hello everyone, thanks for joining, and thank you to Ginny for inviting me to speak today. So I'm going to be talking about Thunderbase Open Access Publishing Platforms. So just a little bit about me first. So my name is Tom Ingram. I am currently at the University of Queensland working in the scholarly publishing team with Elena Danilova, and so delivering sessions on scholarly publishing to at UU, and also working on several data analytics projects looking at UU research outputs. So I joined the team in June. Before that, I was at F1000, which is a London science publisher. I was there for 6 years, just under 6 years. And so it's my connection to F1000 research, which is the more open access publishing arm of F1000. So it's my connection, my experience there, which is the reason why I'm talking today about funder-based publishing platforms, because F1000 are very much integrated with this approach and concept. So at F1000, I started off as an associate editor, doing a lot of manuscript checking, and then I moved on to being a publisher, where I was managing article collections, one of the platforms, as well as several publishing initiatives, mainly surrounding open data, reproducibility, and interactivity, including interactive figures. But back to the question, back to the presentation, funder-based publishing platforms. But before I actually describe what these are, it'll be good just to first cover what funders want, what they're looking for in a publishing system, and also cover how or whether the current traditional publishing system meets those needs or those desires. And just looking at some other funder-based publishing initiatives before moving on to the publishing platforms. Right. So what do funders want? So science funders all have mission statements. They all have a raison d'être to resolve some sort of societal problem or set of problems. So that might be curing cancer or reducing hunger or eliminating hunger. So usually these very big societal problems which need a lot of knowledge and a lot of research to be able to solve. Now what funders want is to try and maximize the amount of knowledge that is produced by, well, from the projects that they fund. So this quote from Mark Wolpert and Paul Gress. So Paul is at Hewlett Foundation. And Mark was at head of the Wellcome Trust back in 2011 when this was written, and is now head of UK Research and Innovation. So here they say the populations who participate in research and the taxpayers who foot the bill have the right to expect that every last ounce of knowledge will be wrung from the research. So that is the biggest drive, is trying to maximize the amount of knowledge that can be extracted from any given project. So because science and research is cumulative, the more knowledge that is produced for a given project and the more knowledge is made available, then the more people can use that knowledge and build upon it and create even more knowledge, and therefore increase the chances or the likelihood of being able to solve these societal problems. So that's one aspect of it. So they want to get as much knowledge as possible, and they want to make this knowledge as accessible as possible so as many eyes can look on it and make use of it and build upon it. And the best way of doing that is to make the research findings available to everybody without any barriers. So there's the open access movement, which has been going on for almost 20 years. And then more recently, there's been moves to get more research outputs, not just the final article, but out there in the open so people can start making use of it and building on it, most notably research data, but also code, whether that's sort of software infrastructure or whether it's more analytical code, made that available as well so that others can use it, and also materials such as antibodies and other reagents. And making that open and making it easier for people to access those without having, let's say, IP restrictions on them. So it's all well and good getting knowledge out there, but you've got to make sure that that knowledge is actually an accurate representation of the world. It has to be robust. It has to be rigorous, because otherwise that's not, I mean, producing research which isn't robust is going to prevent, or at least delay a funder's ability to meet the goals of their mission statement. And so that's obviously very important. They don't want to waste money on producing research which is not robust and can't be translated into the clinic or the real world, or even based on other basic, or even fueling other basic research projects. And so there's an incentive for funders to try themselves incentivize pro-reproducible behaviors with the researchers that they fund. Then, of course, there's funders want to try and achieve their goals as quickly as possible. Like, I'm sure Cancer Research UK would prefer to develop a or be helped develop and discover a treatment for cancer within 10 years rather than 30 years. And it'd be preferable to introduce a new effective clinical technique into the practice within 9 months of its discovery rather than 18 months, because there's obviously lives will be saved or quality of life will be improved in those cases. And so it's in the funder's interest to try and reduce any potential delays that for people to be able to access the knowledge that's produced within reason. And finally, this is more of a recent development, but transparency with operations with funders has become a much bigger deal. Partially through just a general move towards openness and accountability, but also things like the reproducibility crisis and criticism of experts that we've seen in some parts of the world have led to both a knock of confidence in research findings within both the research community, but also the wider public. And that's something that funders, especially public funders, whose funds come from taxpayer money, are very keen to try and rebuild, or at least stabilize. And then finally, all of this should be as cost-effective as possible. So resources are always going to be limited, even with big funders. And any savings that they make can be funneled straight back into new research, either directly or through reinvesting it and funding new research based on those investments. So that's very important, but it can't be so cheap that it's unsustainable. So they want the system to continue, and so they will. There's always incentive to try and support certain business models that will ensure the stability and sustainability of this sort of publishing approach. Sorry, I'm trying to skip. It's just a bit of delay. Right, so that's the dream. In terms of the reality, so several funders, and I have to, I'll just say now that a lot of this talk is going to be more focused on developments within Europe and America and less so on Australia, just because a lot of the funder base platform and the relevant and the related developments have all happened in those two theatres. So a lot of this will be, European focused and especially welcome focused. But just going back to the reality of what funders face in trying to achieve those goals set out on the previous slide. So trying to increase open access publishing, like in Europe, that's taken more of a gold OA route. I know in Australia it's more of a green green route is preferred. But either way, gold open access has open access across the board has been quite slow to take root, or at least far slower than funders would want, ideally like. So since the advent of open access in the early 2000s, roughly 20 years ago, some estimates have put the proportion of open access, well, papers published open access per year at about 15 to 33%, which after a 20-year period isn't ideal. Like you'd expect a bigger proportion of outputs to be open access by now. But even though there's not that much, I mean, still open access still constitutes the minority of articles published, the costs of publishing per article have been rapidly. So I've got some graphs on a later slide that show quite how rapidly this growth has been, at least in Europe. But this is obviously an issue for funders because they're the ones who often have to foot the bill for that. And if that's going to be taking large chunks out of their research budget, then that means that there's less resources to fund other projects. Then there's just the practicalities of trying to convince people to go open access. So I know that the Wellcome have had in the past issues with trying to ensure that their grantees have in fact published open access and that the publishers have actually followed through on their open access intentions. So like in some cases, articles that were APCs were paid, those articles weren't made open access or weren't deposited into PubMed Central, still had paywalls levied on them. And in some cases that was the fault of the publisher, in some cases that was the fault of the researcher. For example, the researcher hadn't paid the APC. But it's still always, like when the funder is wanting to get maximum open access compliance, it's these sort of niggly things, which is can create a disproportionate burden on the funder. And then going away from open access, we've seen the reproducibility crisis, even though obviously we don't know how bad reproducibility was pre-2012 when all this started to kick off. So the issue here is that there's lots of certain practices which are believed to be incentivized by certain publishing practices that have exacerbated the proportion of research that is considered not reproducible. So I know there's a range of estimates in there's one that out of the United States that the proportion of research that I think this was based in 2015 that was of clinical research or biomedical research that was considered not reproducible was anywhere between 18% and 85%, which in monetary terms, if we take the midpoint, which is roughly 50, it was something like $29 billion worth of research funds that have just poofed into thin air. Just because, yeah, I mean, there's lots of reasons for that, such as p-hacking, putting detailed enough descriptions into the methods. There's the publication bias that you get from journals chasing after sort of more positive sexy results and not providing an outlet for negative results. So you start getting that publication bias. And then there's just certain outputs which journals aren't particularly interested in, especially ones that focus more around data and software. In those cases, there's very few outlets for researchers to make these outputs available, which are potentially can have a lot of use. And then, of course, there's still the whole question about how best to evaluate scientists. And at the moment, the most commonly assumed way is by judging them based on the title of the journal or the impact factor of the journal where they publish. And those high impact factors are usually driven by editorial practices where they are very highly selective, just choosing a very small number of a large submission of publications to publish. And so that ends up driving up their rejection rates and therefore their desirability. And a lot of these, because they have such high rejection rates, it's very difficult for them to operate an open access business model because their per article charges are super, super high. And so there still is an incentive for researchers to publish in these journals. But there's these disincentives for these journals to switch to open access. So that's a problem. And there's also this other problem where sections of the community consider open access journals to be inherently of lower quality. I'm not 100% sure why. But that's something which funders who want their work to be seen as by as many people as possible, that's another issue that they have to try and address. And then finally, that the publishing system, as all of you know, has until recently remained relatively unchanged since the mid-1600s when the first journal was launched. And the entire system, whether that's production processes, submission systems, or just the wider system where a researcher will have to submit to a journal, wait several months to hear back, revise, resubmit, wait several months, then end up getting rejected, move to the next journal, do the exact same process over and over again, which eats up a huge amount of time, delays research being published and uses up a lot of editorial and review time. And these reviewers are, of course, researchers who can be doing research rather than re-reviewing multiple papers over and over again that have already been reviewed. So the reproducibility, that's just what this graph on the right shows. So this is from that paper which estimated the cost of irreproducibility in US preclinical research. And so, yeah, these are the ranges of some of the studies that tried to reproduce a bunch of other studies. So this particular graph shows between 50 and 89%, but there's some estimates which are lower. Ooh. Right, so there's now the incentives, because the current or the traditional publishing system doesn't align that well anymore with funder goals. Funders have, of course, tried to try and influence or shape the publishing system to try and better fit within their goals. So at least some funders have. So the most common and widespread one is by implementing open access incentives or even mandates. So I believe the Wellcome were the first to do this back in 2003 or 2006, around about that time, where they mandated that articles of the grantees that they fund had to be made open access after a certain period. This is now a quite common policy throughout most funders. Many funders will have an open access policy, whether that's immediate open access publication with no embargo, like the Gates Foundation have at the moment, or whether it's 6 months embargo or 12 months embargo, like NHMRC and ARC have. Most major funders will have an open access policy. And you can look at these, the policies of each funder, if you go to a resource called Sherpa Juliet. So these open access incentives and mandates have gradually become stronger over time. And then obviously the strongest has been the most recent announcement by Schmitz from the European Commission announcing Plan S. So I'm sure all of you would have read about Plan S already. It's a very, very, very strong commitment to promote open access. within projects funded by a consortium of European-based researchers. These are ones are based in the Netherlands, the UK, Sweden, Slovenia, Italy, and a few others. And it's almost certain that the European Commission will join as well. Although they've just got to go through a few other, they've got some other issues to debate first before they actually sign on. So that's so the reason why it's so strong is partially because there's the commitment to ensure that every single article that is produced from their funding will be made open access immediately. So no embargo periods at all. And then there's also the banning of hybrid journals. Now, I'll talk about hybrid journals a little bit later. But hybrid journals are, and I'm sure lots of you would already be familiar with them, but they are sort of dual model journals where they are by default subscription, but will allow researchers to make their work open access at a additional fee, and that fee is usually very high, or at least significantly higher than most full open access journals. So I mean, they're in nominal terms a lot more expensive, but also there's the concern that you're kind of paying twice for the same research output. So if the institution has a subscription, then the publisher is getting money from the subscription to that journal, but also the which includes the open access publications as well as getting money from the APC paid by the author or the funder. And so that's one of the reasons for this ban on hybrids, because they've always seemed to be a transitionary measure. But there's a general feeling that this transition has taken too long. And so they've got to make a very robust stance on banning them. So more directly, there has been an attempt to actually set up a journal, a funder-based journal, or at least a consortium of journals, of funders setting up a journal. So this is, of course, eLife, which was set up in 2012-13, with funds from the Wellcome Trust, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and the Max Planck Society. So eLife, the reason why eLife was set up, or at least the primary reason why eLife was set up, was as a reaction to this idea that open access journals are inherently of lower quality. And so this was an effort to make a real prestigious journal that published very interesting, very high impact studies that could compete with the likes of Nature and Science. And so that's what they're addressing with the creation of eLife. Of course, eLife also is quite innovative and plays around with lots of different publishing strategies. So things like they're publishing decision letters openly, so people can read them. I think they're trialing at the moment an effort to, so any submission that gets accepted, that gets desk accepted, will go on to be published no matter what the reviewers say. So it's kind of like a semi-post-publication peer review attempt, which will be interesting to see how that pans out. But primarily it was to address this issue of open access not being of high quality. It doesn't necessarily address some of the other issues that we saw in the previous slides. And then there's some dabbling in preprints. So preprints are servers where researchers can upload their initial findings before they get peer-reviewed and published in journals. And this process normally takes a day, and so researchers can get their work out very, very quickly, and they can get other researchers to start commenting on them quickly, or they can claim precedence for their work very quickly. And so there's an organization called ASAP Bio, which has several funders on their working group, including the Wellcome, who are looking at how best to incentivize researchers to post preprints before actually going down the formal publication route. This takes us onto the open research platform. So these are possibly the most direct involvement of funders into the publishing system. So there are a number that have been launched so far. So the first one was by the Wellcome Trust, Wellcome Open Research, which was launched in late 2016. I think it was in October. So the Wellcome were the first to do that. Then this was followed by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who launched Gates Open Research. That was in the end of 2017. Then there was HRB Open Research, which was launched by Health Research Board Ireland, which is the first public funder to launch their own publishing, open access publishing platform. Then there was the African Academy of, the African Academy for the Advancement of Science. Sorry, African Academy of Sciences, which launched shortly afterwards. So the AAS are an established society, a Pan-African society, which distributes funding to multiple research projects in Africa. They in turn get funding from other funders like the Wellcome or the Gates Foundation. So those are the four established funder publishing platforms. There are others, institutional-based ones. So there's one run by the Montreal Neurological Institute, and another which will be launched soon by Great Ormond Street Hospital and the Institute of Child Health at UCL. So those are the ones in existence, and then they're the ones that which are coming. So the next one to come will most likely be the Association of Medical Research Charities, which is a consortium of 24 medical research charities based in the UK. They've set up their own platform. And then there's going to be the very, very big one, which is the European Commission, which has put out a tender to launch its own publishing platform earlier this year. I think it was in March. And the tenders have been received and they're going through, and not sure exactly when they'll announce who exactly is going to get the contract for that. But I'm sure it'll be in the next couple months. So the features of these open research publishing platforms. So they are set up by a specific funder or consortium of funders, and they're open just to the grantees that they fund and their collaborators. They also carry the funder's name, so the platforms are branded. So Wellcome will have Wellcome Open Research, Gates will have Gates Open Research. And so that's quite important because it's quite difficult to set up a new publishing system or new journal effectively. And so these, having an established organization, especially an established reputable organization, lend their name to this project, creates a lot of trust in the project. And trust and reputation are the most important considerations that researchers have when they're choosing where to publish. They don't want to publish somewhere that might disappear in 2 or 3 years. They also don't want to publish in somewhere where they are unsure of the reputation, because that's exactly how their research will be judged, at least in the first couple of years before they start accruing citations, is they'll be judged on the place where it's published. And if it's a place, and if it's published in a place where nobody knows about, or there's nobody has heard the name before, then that makes it a lot harder. But having the funder lend their name to the project creates trust that this is a serious project. And two, that it's that it's a serious project, and also mine's gone blank. I'll come back to that. So another key aspect of these publishing platforms is that they're owned by the funder or by the consortium of funders. So this is, although it's owned by the publisher, it's owned by the funder, it's contracted out to a specific publisher. Now, in all these cases, at least the existing open research platforms, the contracted publisher is F1000 or F1000 Research, who run the editorial processes, manage the peer review, and provide the infrastructure on which these articles will be published. But it is owned by the funder. So if this creates a system where a funder can, at least can potentially move their operations to another publisher if that publisher doesn't either fulfill its duties or doesn't provide the right level of service, or who's or if another publisher comes along that better aligns with the funder's goals, then they can move their operations to there as well. And so that's important in terms of the governance and ownership of the of these platforms. And then, so all of these are currently run by F1000 Research, and the technology is provided by F1000 Research, with the exception of the European Commission one. That one, we don't know who will take on that that project, but should know in a couple months. And so all of these platforms, because they are run by F1000 Research, follow the F1000 Research model of publishing. So F1000 Research is a standalone publisher. It's kind of like a journal. It doesn't like to call itself a journal, but a lot of the processes and checks that it does pretty much make it a journal. So, and the main features of this of these platforms are, one, that they're incredibly quick to publish research. They're pretty radically open and transparent. They've incorporated a lot of innovative publishing techniques, and it's also a very low cost operation. So first, I'll just describe the model which all of these follow. And this is, the model is important because the model is how these platforms achieve their speed of publication and getting research out there to the wider research community and general public to start building on these findings as quickly as possible. So we know there's very long average time from submission to publication in the traditional system. I know some estimates have put it around about 9 months. And the biggest rate limiting step is the length of time it takes to solicit and invite and publish peer reviews, ask for peer reviews. This is an incredibly slow process anyway, which is not great if your aim is to try and accelerate research. This becomes even more critical during sort of national emergencies or global emergencies, most notably things like outbreaks, like the Ebola outbreak, that the 2014-16 Ebola outbreak, or the Zika outbreak that followed it. So in these sort of situations, it's super critical to make your research data, your articles, everything available as quickly as possible so that people can start assimilating that knowledge and building on it quickly or translating it into the clinic. So one of the reasons why these various funders have chosen the F1000 Research platform is because there's a system to try and make these articles available as quickly as possible. And the way they do that is, instead of having peer review before publication, they have peer review after publication. So you can see the workflow that an article will go through down below in this diagram. So an article will be submitted. It'll take roughly 7 days to publication. It can be much, much quicker, or it can be slower depending on how responsive the authors are. So the editorial staff at F1000 Research will do a number of different checks to make sure that the research has got the appropriate ethics approval, that it's that all the material methods have been specified so that people can reproduce it if they want to. There to make sure that all research articles are associated with open data sets, and to make sure that the articles comply with various reporting guidelines, most notably the ones listed in the Equator Network, things like the ARRIVE guidelines for animal research or CONSORT for clinical research. So once it's passed those, then the article will get typeset and published. So yeah, so this can be anywhere between 2 and 14 days total from submission to publication. But the average is about 7. And then upon publication, that's when you get the peer reviewers are invited. So what will happen is that the authors will choose a bunch of different referees suggestions. The F1000 research staff will check them to make sure that there's no conflicts of interest and that they have suitable expertise. And if they pass those checks, then they'll invite them. And then those reviewers are asked to either give an approved status, that's like green tick, and approve of reservations, which is pretty similar to a major revisions in the traditional peer review system. And then there's a not approved. And so these statuses are assigned based on whether the reviewer perceives the research to be sound. So they're not judging based on novelty or sexiness or anything like that. It's very much following the sort of the PLOS One and Biomed Central approach, where it's just judging on soundness of science. And if the article passes peer review, and passes peer review here is defined as either getting 2 approved statuses or 1 approved and 2 approved reservations, then the article gets indexed in all the major databases, so Scopus or PubMed, Embase, there's a few. If it doesn't, then the authors have the chance to revise their paper, incorporate the reviewer's suggestions, and then publish a new version which gets layered on top of the old one. And then the reviewer is asked to re-review, and if everything is satisfactory this time, then the article gets indexed. And so that's what the reviewers are doing. They're not determining whether the article gets published, but they're determining how visible the article ultimately becomes by being indexed. But because the article is published and publicly available so quickly, then others, especially experts who might not necessarily need to rely on peer reviews immediately, can make their own judgment call on that piece of research and then potentially use it to inform their own work. So just an example with Wellcome Open Research. So these are the submission times that were submission to publication and submission to passing peer review and being indexed times based on 2017 data. So you can see this is very quick. So so from submission to indexed, the median is going to be the most appropriate measure in this case, rather than mean, just because like citation rates, peer review times are log normally distributed. So there's a lot that are towards the left, towards the lower number of days, and there's usually just a couple at the very higher end, which increase the mean by quite a lot. So the median is 66 days. And if you look at the median of most other journals, it's roughly about 240 days. With the lower estimates usually around 95 days. So it is at least a month quicker than the quickest approaches out there. Right, and so another feature of these platforms is that they're very open. So they are, all the articles are open access, that's default, and so I should mention that they are gold open access, so that the funder does pay a fee per article. This is generally lower than most APCs, so I'll come on to that later. So the article needs to be open access, but then it goes beyond that. So if it's a research article, then it has to have data, open data associated with the article at the time of publication. That's something which is mandatory. That's something that a lot of funders want, because that data can be reused or be used to check the veracity of the claims. But that's something that funders find hard to comply, they find hard for people to ensure compliance. So that's something which the publisher is in a position to do. They can insist that articles are not published until they actually have the data associated with them. And that's also true if they are papers that have analytical code written in R or Python or MATLAB, that can be associated with the article at the beginning as well. So in addition to that, the platform also allows a bunch of other different research outputs, which are non-traditional, not just reviews and not just original research articles, the sort of ones which tend to have a long story attached to them. They also provide a place where other research outputs can be published. So articles just describing discrete data sets with no further analyses, or ones describing software or packages, or particular like Python libraries. Or it could be single findings, or rather, because in a lot of cases, most journals will ask researchers to, or at least reviewers will, to do more experiments to try and build up more of a story, which is fine in some cases, but in some cases that's impossible because the postdoc has left, or it just so happens that that's not the direction that the lab went in. But those single findings can still be useful for others to build on. And of course, then there's the publication of things like negative results as well. So making those openly available. So the platform allows all these sort of outputs to be published and shared and be peer reviewed. And then the openness also extends to the peer review process itself. So the peer review is both transparent and open. So the reviewers are named, you can see it on this on the right-hand side. Their statuses are published alongside the article, and then their actual full reviews are published alongside the article as well. And these are citable. They are you can claim them in ORCID, so you can start getting credit for the reviews that you produce. And this is important in trying to incentivize open, transparent behaviors in researchers. And also the author can respond to research to the reviewers as well. So they don't necessarily have to incorporate all their suggestions. They can give a succinct explanation about why that they aren't necessarily going to address that point. And this is all out in the open and can provide a really nice resource for readers to read these reviews and then start putting the main article in context and start getting a better idea of its strengths and limitations, as well as some more contextual information. And also metrics are tracked for each of these reviews. So you can start measuring the impact of your reviews, which are scholarly outputs in their own right. I realize we don't have a huge amount of time left, so I'll speed through. So the platforms also have a focus on trying to promote reproducibility and doing so in innovative ways. So one is just allowing things like replications and reanalyses to be published. Now, a lot of traditional journals are quite recalcitrant about allowing that to happen, especially the journals which have published the original study, which is being replicated or reanalyzed in the first place. So allowing that just provides a forum to show whether the community has done extra work to test the veracity of previously published claims. We've spoken about mandating data and code sharing. That's very important for ensuring reproducibility, because then when you can actually look at the code or look at the data, you can check to see whether there's any mistakes in it, or whether if you were to choose a slightly different analytical approach, whether you'd get the same result or not. These platforms all incorporate things like these computational reproducibility widgets. So this is done in partnership with a startup called CodeOcean. So you provide these little portals within the article where it'll load all the scripts, it'll load all the data, and then you can run it. It will reproduce the entire analysis, and print out the results. And then you can go in and upload your own data. You can use the same analytical scripts, or you can go in and change the scripts themselves to see if that, how much that would change the results. So you can start playing around without having to install a bunch of dependencies, which you normally have to do. Then there's other innovations like registered reports, which admittedly several other journals are doing as well, most notably ones in psychology. So registered reports are attempts to reduce incidence of things like p-hacking or hypothesizing after the data is collected. And so in this case, this is where an article is published, but the article is just constitutes an introduction and methods. Then the peer reviewers come in, review it, give some feedback. The researchers have already stated exactly what they're going to measure, so they can't just keep on doing statistical tests until they get something significant. And then they are given the, they're guaranteed to have a publication afterwards, once the results are collected, no matter whether the results are negative or positive, regardless of what their significance level is. So that's something that funders like the Wellcome really wanted to include, and then they can because it's their own platform. And then there's the reporting guideline editorial checks that I mentioned before, which the more information you have, particularly with methods, then the easier it is to reproduce a study. Okay, so now on to the cost effectiveness of the platforms. So these graphs just show, well, the graph on the left shows the historical trend of article processing payments per article. So these are means for COAF. So that's the charity Open Access Fund. So that's a collection of, I think it's 6 UK-based funders that include the Wellcome Trust and the British Heart Foundation and Parkinson's UK. And it's they every year they track exactly how much they spend per article. So you can see that since 2013, this has been increasing. It's particularly so between 2015 and 2017. So that is an 11% jump, which is far more than inflation, which is like 2-3%. And the trends are going up to suggest that it'll be even more next year. And what's driving a lot of this increased spending is the proportion that are published in hybrid journals. So you can see that 70% of the articles over this period, so it ranges between 75 and 70, are published in hybrid journals, which is a huge percentage, especially when you look at the graph to the right, where you see the cost difference between a full open access article and a hybrid article. So there's almost an £800 difference between the two for the average APC. So this is part of the reason for Plan S cutting out hybrid journals to try and control these costs. But even full open access fees are increasing, and they're still like they're not cheap. And then so when you compare the mean article APC for the Wellcome's open publishing platform, Wellcome Open Research, you can see it's almost half of the full open access option. So this is where, so Wellcome, in this case, the Wellcome, is saving quite a lot of APC money, which it can then use to replow into further research projects or into further investment. So that's a big pull of why funders are also moving towards these publishing platforms as well. I know I've only got about 3 minutes left, so I'll just very quickly talk through some of the challenges. Yeah. So there's conflict of interest. So is there a conflict of interest between funder and controlling its own publishing system? So in theory, yes. But this is one of the reasons why the publishing operations are contracted out to a third party, to a publisher. In this case, so having that separation and having the editorial policies determined by the publisher means that all those editorial decisions are made independently of the funder. So that separation is important, but also transparency is important. So you need to have transparent editorial guidelines. The transparent peer reviews also helped, showing exactly why a particular article was accepted that wasn't accepted due to undue pressure from the owner of the platform. So you can actually, having those peer reviews open is helpful for that as well. There's also the issue of lock-in, so technological lock-in. So where the funder's operations get so enmeshed with that current publisher that ends up being stuck with them, and it just becomes prohibitively expensive to try and move everything over to another platform. So even though the funder might own the platform, they don't necessarily make it easy to move it across. So I mean, lock-in is not a new issue. Like society journals have encountered exactly the same thing when trying to move between publishers. But there are efforts to try and make these platforms, or at least the data, the workflows, and the contents that they contain much more portable. In fact, that's one of the criteria for the European Commission Open Research Platform, is that it has to be portable and given back to the European Union at the end of the four-year contract. There's a long-term governance issue. So yes, each platform is owned by the funder. But how about the technology and how about the wider publishing approach? So F1000 formed something called Open Research Central a year or two ago. And that's together with the funders who currently have their open research funding platforms. And so the idea is that this will then be transitioned across to a governance group comprised of several research funders as well as others in the research organizations within the wider science community. So the first step of that has already been completed. It has been registered as a non-profit, and then the transition will end up will probably take a bit longer to moving it to ownership by that interest group. Then there's smaller or no funders. So if you don't have funding, then you can't publish on one of these platforms because it's only open to their grantees. Also, setting up the platform has its own costs, and so which might be prohibitive for smaller charities. So one solution is you can follow the AMRC's route, form a consortium, and then pool your resources, which then makes everything a lot more cost effective. But then again, if you wanted to publish on these sort of platforms with open peer review and post-publication peer review, there are other options. I mean, there is F1000 Research, which is funder agnostic, but then F1000 Research is more life science focused. If you're more sort of atmospheric chemistry and physics focused, there's a dedicated journal for that, which operates in a very similar manner. Research evaluation is far too big a topic to go in the next minute. But just to mention that there are groups involving the Wellcome, the Gates Foundation, the Arnold Foundation, the Sloan Foundation, the Montreal Neurological Institute, they're all getting together. And so they have multiple working parties which are looking at trying to incorporate these sort of outputs that are published on these platforms, but also other non-article outputs in general, how best to evaluate those and how to move away from things like the impact factor and H-index in their grant evaluations. And then finally, this is more of a practical issue of cross-discipline norms when it comes to publishing. So life science and medicine tend to have similar norms when it comes to publishing. The physical sciences tend to have similar norms. And then the humanities and economics tend to have similar norms. But they're quite different between them. So this is fine when you have a platform which is only dealing with one of those disciplines. But if you have a grand platform, let's say like the European Union one, where you have to be able to publish across everything that funds, so that's everything from life sciences to physics to social sciences, that gets quite difficult in terms of the expectations with the peer review process and the publishing process. And because to accommodate them, you end up having to have lots of different workflows, and which in turn increases the complexity and increases the chances of mistakes and increases the cost of the entire system. So that is another challenge to bear in mind. But with that, I will finish because I know I've gone over. Here's some engagement statistics, which you can look at. So these just in the bottom left-hand corner, this just shows the outputs for each of the research, the funder open research platforms. So this is based on Dimensions data. It's, the uptake has been very significant. So even though the numbers are relatively small as a proportion of, in terms of the rankings of publications that are published on these platforms, for Wellcome, it's the fourth most common platform where its grantees publish. For the Gates, it's the third, and for Health Research Board Ireland, it's the first. And that's pretty incredible considering HRB is only 6 months old. Okay, now I'll finish. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much, Tom. That's tremendous. And thank you especially for bearing with us through the technological challenges, but thank goodness for laptops, eh? So we are over time. I'm going to, but since we start a little bit late, I'm going to sort of leave it open for about 5 minutes so in case people do want to ask some questions. There's a couple of things that have come up in the chat that I'm just going to ask Tom to reflect on. And just as a reminder to everybody, this is being recorded and the slides will go up on our website as well, so you can have a look at them there afterwards. A couple of things from Margie Janty, who actually has had to leave unfortunately, some of which you've covered actually. One is around the openness of the peer review, which we talked about, but maybe you could talk about whether that, how important that is as an integral part of the platform. Another one about new methods of assessing journals, which again you touched on with the sort of DORA initiative and such like. One other question that's also just cut, Richard White from New Zealand just asked about the reaction of the researchers to the openness of the peer review process. So perhaps you could talk about that.
Sure. So the first question was how integral open peer review was.
Yes, and the reaction of the researchers to that.
Okay, I'll cover those two in one. So the open peer review process is pretty important to the funders who have launched these platforms for a couple of reasons. One is their desire to incentivize sort of open practices. So peer review, when it's anonymous, no credit can be claimed for it. But when it's open, then it's, and your name is attached to it, then you can start claiming credit for it. And that can then, especially when there's a DOI attached to it, then you can start potentially using those as part of evaluations. Not that they necessarily will go down this route, but there is a potential option. And having these reviews open also allows for peer review to be properly studied, which is of great interest to funders as well, looking at the quality of the peer reviews. And again, this harks back to the whole thing about trying to maximize the amount of knowledge which is openly available, and peer review reports are a pretty important form of knowledge. And so having that available might help readers looking at the article interpret the article in a slightly different way and get more information out of it and more knowledge out of it. In terms of how the researchers have felt about the open peer review process, so out of everything that the platforms do, so in fact you have the this graph on the right hand side shows this is again for Wellcome, and it's only based on 42 respondents. But why they published on that platform, or what they enjoyed about that platform, publishing on the platform. So a bunch did say that the open peer review process was important for them publishing. And as part of the survey, which I haven't included in the presentation, the vast majority, I believe it was about 2/3, said that they thought what open peer review was important for things like making the tone of the discussion more collegial and more constructive, rather than just being shot down by undue criticism where the reviewer can hide behind anonymity. But there was some concern that the reviews might not be as critical and rigorous as completely blind ones. So I know there have been studies in the past by journals like the British Medical Journal and British Journal of Psychiatry, which have looked at the quality and rigor of open peer reviews compared to anonymous peer reviews. And in both cases, well, in the BMJ's case, I know they saw that the quality was comparable between the two. There's no real difference. The only difference was that open peer review took a little bit longer than closed peer review. And the British Journal of Psychiatry study actually saw that the quality was slightly better with open peer review versus the non-signed peer review. So there is a little bit of caution from the researchers, but the studies that have been done have showed that the quality is comparable, if not better. But again, these studies are also quite old. They're sort of from 2008. Not sure if there's any other studies that have been done recently.
Great, thanks. I mean, I think the other point that I would just add is it's very striking, the note about the increase in APC costs, and Richard made a comment about that, that, you know, I think a lot of people did predict perhaps that there was going to be an, you know, sort of arms race in APC costs, and it duly came to pass, and those costs are now unsustainable. So it's very interesting to see this as a model for sustainable open access that funders are addressing.
Right.
Well, I think that given we're over time, I'll wrap this up. Thanks very much for doing that. I think everybody's found it very interesting. Some comments coming in from the chat about how valuable it was. The slides will be up.
Yep.
Thomas is at UQ. You know where to find him.
I'll put my email up as well, so you can get in contact.
Fantastic. And if anyone has any other comments, please just put them through on Twitter, and we'll be happy to follow up there as well. So thanks very much, everybody, and hope to see you next time at our next webinar.
Great. No, thank you.